Cyrus?
Death gave a low chuckle. Cute. Just for that, you won't die of cancer in 20 years.
What?
We need to discuss your next assignment, Death said, confidently striding across the graveyard to an unknown destination. I followed her, keeping my head low. I'm kinda busy right now. Personal stuff. Things like resurrecting my wife and dealing with the fact my best friend is in love with me.
Would you like me to raise your wife from the dead?
Yeah, I said, suspecting it wouldn't be that easy. It would be really nice if you helped with that.
No,
I sighed. Why am I not surprised? Death answered my thought. Because you know me better than any other mortal. Your wife made the choice of her own free will and accord to take a blow meant for Cindy Wachowski. You promptly made a similar choice to use black magic in order to restore her, knowing it came from an unclean source. It's not my place to clean up your mistakes.
I think you owe.
Careful, Death interrupted.
Her,
I said simply.
More.
I don't owe anyone anything, Gary, but complete fairness. I kill the rich, poor, greedy, and charitable alike. I strike children, the elderly, the sick, and the healthy. I am the great equalizer you always are talking about when you preach your anarchist philosophy. I was here when the universe began, and I will be here when the universe ends.
Please.
Death stopped walking. Gary, do you know where your wife is?
No.
A better place. People say that a lot, and sometimes they mean it, sometimes they don't. She is with her goddess. Do you really want to rip her from that?
I was silent and looked over the grave sites around.
Is it so wrong to say the answer is yes, I want to be with her? Hell, knowing there's an afterlife, don't think I didn't contemplate suicide. The only thing that stayed my hand is I don't think we'd go to the same place.
More than that stayed your hand, Death said, her eyes seeming to look right through me.
You love life even if you loved your wife every bit as much.
I looked down at my feet. There's nothing I wouldn't do to bring her back.
Kill Cindy, and Mandy's soul will return to her body.
What?
I said.
What?
Cloak joined me. Death's voice became almost contemptuous.
You're pestering me for a cure from Mandy's condition. Well, there's your cure. Mandy died for Cindy. Give up Cindy and Mandy will become human again. It may or may not be her soul anymore, but it'll be as close as you're likely to get. Make your choice between them now.
I stared at her, horrified.
You evil!
Careful.
I
looked down at my hands, then turned away.
No, not Cindy. Anyone else.
A baby, then.
What?
I snapped back.
Death sighed.
You use a lot of hyperbole, but I think you're less of an unfettered force of nature than you think.
Why are you doing this?
To simply illustrate the consequences of her choice are not wholly negative. Mandy's death has made you a better person. You, Cindy, and others. One act of heroism serving as a domino to others. You should take that into account and respect her choice.
I looked away. Fine, I'll find another way to do this. With or without you, I'm bringing her back.
Death shook her head. Then that, too, will be of your own free will and accord. I almost said, thanks for nothing, but decided to bite my tongue.
Is there anything else?
A nexus has died.
A what now?
Cloak explained.
A nexus is an individual who, by some quirk of their nature or events, is one of the single most important individuals in the history of everything.
I generally don't hold with the one great man of history thing, I said, shrugging. Individuals don't make history, people.
And you would be wrong, Death explained. This individual has saved the universe on numerous occasions, rescued countless worlds, inspired billions, and done more good than the collected histories of several civilizations.
I blinked.
So one of the big players in the superhero world?
Yes, Death said.
Someone I know?
Yeah.
I tried to think of the various people it could be. The Nightwalker was at the top of the list, but he died and became Cloak. Then there's Ultra God, but I couldn't believe that would ever happen. He was the symbol of everything good in the world, not to mention the father of my ex-girlfriend, Gabrielle. I couldn't see him dying. Ever.
That is a poor way to view the world. As great as Moses Anders is, at the end of the day, he is only human. Eventually, someday, he will go out into one of those many million-to-one odd fights and never return.
It is the fate of all superheroes, and one we have to accept if we are to face the sort of enemies we do.
Is it Ultra God?
I was afraid of the answer. I was surprised how little I cared about losing my protection. Instead, all I could think about was how his loss would devastate the superhero world, and Gabrielle in particular. He'd been a symbol of hope and freedom for the entirety of the world. No, it couldn't be him. Impossible.
That is not my place to tell.
Just give vague, somewhat annoying clues to, huh?
That is the prerogative of gods, yes.
I rolled my eyes. So what exactly is it you want with his death, assuming it's already happened?
I want you to help solve it.
I raised an eyebrow. This seems a little out of your wheelhouse, since when has death ever cared about justice?
Not justice, pride.
Eh?
The man who died had an appointed hour of death far from now, at a moment of epic cosmological importance. I am taking steps to rectify the situation so the destiny of the universe is not disrupted. But this is against the rules. People are not supposed to go off script.
I thought you said we had free will and accord.
You do, but only within the lines.
Of course. One thing I'd found to be true in this reality, and every other one, was there was never pure freedom. No matter where you went, there were the haves and the have-nots. The haves were always trying to make sure the have-nots didn't become the gotta-gets, too.
So someone broke destiny and you want me to whack them?
Essentially, yes.
What do I get in return?
My continued goodwill.
Keep going. Storm clouds slowly moved over the horizon and the sun disappeared. I conjured a beach umbrella made of ice above both me and Death, letting it catch the dark drizzle that poured down. I wasn't fazed in the slightest.
Looks like rain.
Death narrowed her eyes, and I guessed she was debating obliterating me or torturing me for 1,000 years. Instead, she said,
I'll owe you a favor.
What sort of favor? I decided to continue to risk her disfavor. After all, I had nothing to live for, and Mandy worshipped different gods, so what did it matter? If I couldn't have her, it didn't matter what happened to me. Death's offer, though, changed my mind.
You can ask me for anything within my power to grant once this occasion is over.
It was too good to be true.
Of course it is.
I couldn't say no, though.
Including Mandy's return?
Yes.
I struggled to control my emotions, trying not to freak out.
No funny business?
No funny business.
This was going to end badly, I just knew it. All right, I'll be your hitman. Who do you want me to kill?
I can't tell you.
Where is he?
I can't tell you that either.
Can you give me any clues whatsoever?
You will have all you need to find them.
I paused. Are you just fucking with me now?
To answer that would cancel the favor.
So, yes. Death laughed. It was not a pleasant-sounding chuckle, but a full-on belly laugh.
This is the reason I keep you around, Gary. You're an endless source of amusement to a truly jaded soul. In any case, that is all I wanted to talk with you about.
I wasn't quite done yet. One more thing. My powers have been acting up lately. I'll need them in tip-top shape to do this mission, assuming it's not just some random guy on the street I have to shiv.
It's not, and yes, your powers have been affected by recent events, Death said, nodding. You tainted yourself with Zul Barbas's magic when you tried to resurrect Mandy and used the majority of your reserves destroying him. Since that time, you've also been training yourself with foreign magical sources in hopes of finding ways to restore your wife. These diminish your capacity to serve as my avatar.
Speak English, Doc.
You've fucked up and aren't as powerful as you used to be.
Oh.
No more teleporting with the Reaper's Scythe or killing gods. You also have a limited supply of necromantic energy again.
That's definitely going to hurt my ability to take out your target.
I paused.
Hint, hint. Drops a suggestion. Hint, hint.
Fine. Take this, Death said,
conjuring a $40,000 Louis Vuitton purse. Opening it up, she produced an ivory-handled hairbrush and presented it to me. I took the brush and stared at it.
A brush with death. Ha ha, funny.
Take out the scythe with your other hand.
Confused, I produced the tiny pen which could transform into the Reaper's scythe. I was now holding a pen and brush in my hands.
Okay.
Death waved her hand over both, and they became a pair of silver-plated Desert Eagle pistols. The two pistols seemed to connect with a magical energy inside me, and then disappeared into the folds of my cloak. They're made from swords wielded by Greek soldiers during the Maccabean Revolt. They will channel your power through them and shoot out bullets made of hellfire. It will compensate a little for your reduced power.
Will they also allow me to shoot like Chow Yun Fat?
No, you will probably miss everything you shoot at if you fire them at the same time.
Figures.
Beggars couldn't be choosers, though, and if I was going to find and kill someone Death wanted dead, then I needed every advantage I could get. I knew enough magicians I could also probably get the weapons blessed so they could fire themselves, which was good since I wasn't exactly trained on how to use firearms. At all.
I hate guns. The superhero that uses them has shown he is incapable of fighting in a non-lethal manner and thus does not deserve the title.
Thankfully, I'm not a superhero. So, anything else, Death?
Death looked honestly concerned for a moment. It was an expression that didn't sit well on her face.
Good luck, Gary. If it's any consolation, your wife would want you to be happy.
I stared down at the guns in my hand. That's not really her decision to make. I woke up seconds later.
Chapter 6. Where I Meet with the Family. I woke up from my dream with a pounding headache. The encounter with Death was fresh in my mind, and I had mixed emotions about the whole thing. If anyone in the world could bring Mandy back, it was Death, but I'd been burned before dealing with such a being. I had to believe this would be the secret to my salvation. But if it cost me Cynthia, I didn't know what to think.
"You should go speak to her," Cloak said. "Try to resolve this before it is unfixable."
"Why do you care?"
"I could say it is because I pushed away my own family and loved ones, because I know what it is like to die alone because an obsession dominated my life. But in truth, it is because I care for you both. You are like the son and daughter I never had."
"Who you're trying to set up together?"
"All right, that metaphor went in an odd direction.
I'll go talk to her after I'm decent."
"So, never?"
"Ha ha.
Honesty is the best policy," Cloak suggested.
"I've never found that to be the case."
"How do you feel about her?"
I was silent.
"I'm not sure that matters."
"I can't imagine that's the case."
I slipped out of bed, took a shower, and got dressed in a pair of shorts and a Hawaiian shirt with a pair of sandals. A reminder to do the laundry since I was down to vacation apparel. Taking a look in the mirror, I gave myself an appreciative glance. I was a handsome man, a quality that separated me from many of my fellow geeks. My body had seemingly gotten more and more buff the longer I wore the Reaper's cloak. I kept my head shaved since becoming a supervillain, a quality that just seemed right. Also, it concealed the fact I had hair as golden as Jaime Lannister. No one took a blonde supervillain seriously. Putting on a pair of sunglasses, I headed down the hallway to Cindy's room, trying to figure out what I wanted to say to her.
"Do you know how I met Cindy?"
"You met her in a seedy hotel serving as a makeshift brothel. There she was an underaged prostitute and was witness to your murdering the anti-hero shoot-'em-up. She recognized you from school and agreed to keep your secret. You were both 14. Later you befriended her to keep her quiet and became partners in crime until your college years, when she went on to study medicine while you became a history major."
"Yeah," I said. "I've been manipulating Cindy since the first time we met. Even if I did love her, how would I know it wasn't just to keep someone useful by my side?"
"I think you'd know."
"Well, I don't."
The door to Cindy's room was slightly ajar, and heading on in, I saw it had been cleaned out. Gone were weapons, explosives, her stuffed animal collection, and her collection of sexy-themed costumes. The only thing left was a framed selfie of me, Mandy, Diablo Man, and herself. It had been taken during the night of the fall with all of us in costume. The picture was lying on the bed.
"Well, shit." "So what now?" Cloak asked.
"If you love something, set it free. If it comes back, it's yours. If it doesn't come back, it was never yours."
"I've always found that an immensely stupid saying."
"I'll bear that in mind. In the meantime, I'm going to work on solving Death's case."
"I'll lend my aid to you. I was at one point the world's second greatest detective."
"Who was the first?"
"Detective Duck." I shook my head.
"Only in this world."
Heading downstairs, I was struck how lonely the mansion was. Truly, it should have been populated with a horde of servants waiting at my beck and call, but I wasn't comfortable with that sort of life. I had no interest in the Downton Abbey existence and preferred to look after myself. Still, right now, being in a gigantic house with only my immediate family wasn't improving my mood. Seeing a couple of ghosts hanging around my kitchen, I decided to go speak with my sister. The mansion kitchen was larger than my first apartment, with a checkerboard floor, a walk-in freezer we barely used, and a table in the center where both my sister and my niece sat. Sunlight was streaming through the windows, and it looked to be about 7 or 8 in the morning. Carrie wore a black bathrobe with a little spider motif on her label. My niece, Lisa, was a pink-haired girl with pigtails, wearing a pair of hot pants and an ultra-goddess t-shirt. They were having breakfast and coffee with a trio of newspapers on the table. Carrie was my younger sister by a few years, and had been the baby of the family. As a result, she'd never really gotten to know my brother Keith the way I did, and had been immunized to his supervillainous influences. Lisa, by contrast, was his daughter, and had the same level of hero worship for me I'd once had for her father. After Lisa's mother had abandoned her, marrying the publisher of her book, I Was a Supervillain Sex Slave, Lisa had come to live with Carrie instead. Now both of them had decided living in my mansion was better than trying to scrape out a living in New Angeles. It had its downsides, though, like the fact ghosts followed my sister faster than I could dispel them. There were also a half-dozen ghosts present right now, in fact, the most recognizable one being an overweight middle-aged man in a sequin jumpsuit with a cape. He had an epic pair of sideburns and was wearing a pair of mirrored sunglasses that did nothing to disguise his identity. "Shouldn't he be in Graceland?" I asked, pointing to the king.
"Tourists were bad enough when they were alive," the king said. "They've gotten worse after death."
"Ah," I said. "I noticed Cindy left," Carrie said, buttering some toast for me. "What happened last night?"
"Stuff," I said, wondering just how badly I'd screwed up. "How serious did she look?" "In my experience, women do not move out on a whim."
Cindy sang a variation of "Do You Want to Build a Snowman?" called "Do You Want to Rob a Jewelry Store Outside Your Door Before You Woke Up?" Carrie said. When he didn't answer, she took the Ferrari and drove off in a funk.
I blinked. "She went Disney on a breakup? That is serious."
"Are you breaking up? Are you even dating?" Lisa said, looking at me sideways. "I thought you were a supervillain henchwoman shared lunacy sort of thing."
"It's complicated." Carrie buttered some toast for the king.
"Cindy loves Gary. Gary's in mourning for his dead wife, but he kind of likes her as well."
"Okay, perhaps not so complicated."
"What's the problem, then?" Lisa asked. "Gary resurrected Mandy badly with necromancy and is trying to fix his mistake so she's not zombie Mandy anymore," Carrie said, handing the toast to the king.
"Thank you. Thank you very much," the king said, taking it.
"Vampire Mandy, not zombie Mandy," I corrected, "albeit not the sexy kind of vampire. Less Anne Rice and more near dark." "It's all very tragic and dark shadows," Carrie said. "I'm sorry I asked," Lisa said, watching the toast free float to her eyes. "No, seriously, I really am sorry I did." I sat down at the table and picked up my copy of the Falcon Crest City Herald.
"Yeah, well, it's my problem and I'll deal with it."
"Like you've been dealing with everything else since Mandy's death?" Carrie asked. I glared at my sister. "Like you have so much to complain about." "The city is finally starting to recover," Carrie said. "I think you should focus on helping with that. Don't let obsession cloud your judgment and just let time work things out. Maybe Mandy's spook will show up sometime."
"Death said she's at peace." I ignored the rest of her statement.
"Oh, how is she?"
"Fine," I said, checking the newspaper headlines one by one. "Did any major heroes or villains die last night?"
"No," Carrie said. "Not that's been reported. Why?"
"Just a feeling," I said, putting the reports down.
"Listen, things may be getting hairy in the next few days because of a bounty on my head. As a result, there are going to be some safety precautions." "You're finally going to train me to be merciless?" Lisa said, suddenly paying attention.
I frowned at her.
"No. I don't have to be merciless. I could be Danger Girl, Little Lisa, the pink-haired killer, the bubblegum bandit."
"The bubblegum bandit, really?" I asked. Lisa shrugged her shoulders.
"I saw this great deal on Crime Bay for a glue gun. I figured I could use hot pink ammo."
"While not a bad idea, I have to ask, don't you have superpowers?" Lisa was every bit the natural super as Carrie.
"Little light sparks, that barely qualifies."
"Any superpower is better than none at all. Be that as it may, you're not going to be a supervillain."
"Is this one of those do-as-I-say-not-as-I-do things?" Lisa asked, crossing her arms and leaning back in her chair.
"No, it's me telling you you're not going to be a supervillain because I say so. One of the benefits of actually being a supervillain is I don't have to worry about hypocrisy."
During the fall, I had found out from Keith's ghost he'd never wanted me to follow in his footsteps as a supervillain. I'd idolized my brother the same way Lisa now idolized me, and it had been a sobering revelation to discover that Keith was not only horrified by my life choices, but also genuinely remorseful for his actions committed as Stingray. It was too late for me, and by too late I meant I liked being a supervillain and had no intention of stopping, but I wasn't about to let Lisa go down the same road. I'd explained to Lisa about Keith's desires, that crime didn't pay, and both the mental and physical consequences of the supervillain lifestyle. Unfortunately, my living in a gigantic mansion with a sexy supervillainess had given her mixed signals.
"You're the worst supervillain uncle ever," Lisa said, pulling out her cell phone. "I'm texting my friends to tell them how lame you are."
"You do that," I said, taking a glass of orange juice from a small 12-year-old ghost I'd nicknamed Casper. "Either way, I'm going to try and make sure you're protected from the consequences of my actions."
"How's that?"
Carrie asked, looking at the child ghost. "Thank you, Robert."
"I'm going to give you my $1.5 billion.
Lisa stopped texting. Every ghost looked at me. Carrie instead took a sip of her milk.
"That's nice." "You are the best supervillain uncle ever," Lisa said, rushing over to my side and hugging me ecstatically. "I'm going to buy a car today. No, 3 cars. Fuck, I'll buy the entire dealership and then blow it up."
I shook my head. "While I respect your enthusiasm for destruction and mayhem, I'm actually putting it all in Carrie's control until you're 30.
"What the hell?"
Lisa shouted before making a strangling gesture with her right hand.
"Sorry, the Darth Vader throat crush doesn't work in real life. Believe me, I've tried on many an occasion."
Lisa threw out her hands and left the kitchen in disgust.
"What brought on this sudden burst of generosity?" Carrie asked.
"Last night, when I failed to get what I wanted from the left-handed Bokor, I ended up finding out someone has put a substantial price on my head. I'm not sure if it's the government, but if it is, I'd rather you guys were taken care of. You know, in case something were to happen to me."
"That's sweet of you, Gary, but Lisa and I don't need your money. You've been too generous as is."
"Speak for yourself,"
Lisa called from outside the door. "We definitely need his money." Carrie felt her temple.
"She is way too much like you."
"That's what I'm afraid of." I proceeded to conjure an iPhone from the shadows. The Reaper's cloak's extra-dimensional pockets were available even when it wasn't technically in existence. Typing into the phone, I summoned a holographic interface that listed the entirety of my assets. The Brotherhood of Infamy had included some of the wealthiest citizens of Falcon Crest City, and they'd contributed a massive amount of their fortunes to their operating budget. I'd done my best to give it back to the city, but I'd stumbled in a few places, ending up keeping perhaps a bit more than my fair share.
"You mean stealing billions of it and using it to become even richer?"
"Job creator!"
I snapped back. Several keystrokes later, all of my bank accounts emptied out, and I was once more a penniless supervillain.
"There we go," I said, sighing. "I don't have Mandy's gift with computers, but I learned something about covering electronic transfers. Everything I've stolen looks like it's been earned through legitimate business transfers, and it's all yours rather than mine. Indeed, it should look like it's always been yours."
Carrie stopped eating and looked at me.
"Are you really in that much danger, Gary?"
"I'm a supervillain. I'm always in danger."
"Maybe you should reconsider that, then. I have enough ghostly friends."
A young woman who was friends with Carrie in high school, I believe her name was Zoe, gave Carrie a look.
"Not that there's anything wrong with being a spook."
Carrie lifted her hands up defensively. I paused.
"You do realize I intend to borrow $10 or $12 million every month from this, right? And by borrow, I mean spend and never pay you back?"
"Of course, Gary. Just checking." I thought about Carrie's words. Being a supervillain cost me Keith, Mandy, and may have cost me Cindy. I honestly don't know if I should hang it up or not. I do know it's all I've ever wanted to be, though, and I don't know what I'd do with my life if I wasn't.
"Maybe you should think on that and see if there's anything you'd like to be as Gary rather than Merciless?"
It was a thought. Before I could respond, a glowing white streak of light fell from the sky and landed with a thud against the ground outside the kitchen. It caused the garden there to explode, sending up piles of dirt and shattering the windows.
"Oh, dear,"
Carrie said, rising from her chair and immediately going for the dustpan and broom. With a furious devotion, she began cleaning up the broken glass and kitchen like a woman possessed. Lisa popped her head in.
"Did something cool happen?"
"Stay inside," I said, getting up from my chair and rubbing my ears. They were still ringing from the miniature explosion.
"Like hell,"
Lisa shouted.
"Is where I'm going to send you if you don't stay inside," I shouted back. That doesn't actually make sense, Cloak said.
Hush you,
I said. Heading through the kitchen door to the site of the explosion, I saw a 15-foot-long and 2-foot-deep hole in the ground from where the white light had struck. On the ground, in a golden-white uniform, was the brown-skinned and black-haired form of Gabrielle Anders, a.k.a. Ultra Goddess, my ex-girlfriend from college. Her uniform consisted of a white bodysuit with a golden miniskirt and golden thigh-high boots with no insignia on the front like so many other heroes. Her golden cape was tattered and there were cuts all across her face. This despite the fact that she was indestructible. Walking over to her, I slid down into the hole to touch her, only to draw my hand away from her like she was a hot iron skillet. Please, please, don't let her be the superhero who was murdered. I didn't feel the same way for Gabrielle I did in college, but I still cared for her. There was a lot of that going around lately. Gabrielle opened her eyes and slowly climbed to her feet, staring at me. You better be the real Gary. What? Chapter 7. Back when I was dating the Lady of the Night. I remember the first time Ultra Goddess saved my life. I'd been sitting across from Gabrielle at a little outdoors cafe done in a deliberately 1950s retro style, the bright sun and brilliant colors of Atlas City visible around us. It was, in every conceivable way, the opposite of my adopted hometown. There were brilliant white glass skyscrapers, ultra-modern architecture, clean streets, and people who looked genuinely happy to be there. Gabrielle sat across from me, wearing a white sports jersey with a short gold skirt and glasses, her hair back in a ponytail. The fashions of Atlas City tended toward the old-fashioned, but this somehow helped with the wholesome atmosphere. Even so, it was one of the most progressive cities in the country, with its civil rights attorney Polly Pratchett constantly moving to help the disadvantaged. She slurped on her milkshake, looking over at me while I tried to choose where we'd head next on our visit to the city. You've been staring at that thing all day. There's just so much to see. The first Earth-based transstellar spaceport for alien-human interaction. The submarine residential area inhabited by Atlanteans and Marrow. The world's first clean energy fusion plant. So, an airport, the suburbs, and the power plant, Gabrielle said, smiling. I looked down from my map. I know this is all old hat for you, but I've never been in a city like Atlas City. I mean, the air is clean downtown. That's just wrong. Gabrielle chuckled. You can blame Ultra God for the majority of this. You can't have a superhero in a city for 80 years without it impacting things. Yeah. I paused, putting down my map. Ultra God. You're not a big fan of superheroes, Gabrielle said. It was a statement of fact. She'd known it for years. No, I said, looking down. I don't like superheroes. You know about what happened to Keith. Yeah, Gabrielle said, sighing. Shoot 'em Up was the first superhero to start killing criminals. He served as judge, jury, and executioner before inspiring a generation of copycats. Your brother was his second kill out of 57, before someone killed Shoot-'em-up in a dirty hotel in Falcon Crest City. I was silent. Yeah. I know, Gary. I looked up. You do? Gabrielle reached over and put her hand on mine. How long have we been living together? 3 months, I said, smirking. It was a smile without happiness. I know you, Gabrielle said. You're a good person. What you did is something that weighs on your soul every day. You torture yourself because of what happened, and I can see how it warps you. Makes you want to be someone you're not. I see it. I also know you can rise above that. Gabrielle suspected, even if she didn't know, that I was planning on becoming a supervillain. My brother Keith had been Stingray, the underwater assassin. He'd been one of the nefarious nine and had tried to take over Atlantis, the arch-nemesis of both the Silver Lightning and Aquarius. She was right. I had killed Shoot-'em-up and had been thinking about following in my brother's path. To honor him. I loved my brother's memory more than anything on Earth. Or I thought I did. I looked at Gabrielle and squeezed her hand. As long as I have you in my life, the light will drown out the dark. I will never follow in my brother's path as long as I have you. You always will. Gabrielle smiled.
Ugh,
Cindy said from about 3 feet away.
Must you two be so disgustingly saccharine?
I turned around to look at my best friend, who was standing behind us. She was dressed in a red football jersey and black sweatpants.
She had a tray with a fountain drink, burger, and fries on it. Her hair was kept in place with a headband with a little skull pattern on the top.
"Yes?" I answered her automatically.
"Yes, we do."
"What do you suggest we do, Cindy?"
Gabrielle said, smiling. Cindy smiled like a Cheshire cat.
"I say we hit the bars, score some Z, get utterly blitzed, and have a threesome back at the hotel room."
The customer looked up at her.
"What?"
Cindy said, looking back at him.
"Uh-huh," Gabrielle said, looking back at her. "Gary, is your bestie always like this?"
I sighed. "Only when she's sober."
"What's she like when drunk?"
I started to answer, only to be interrupted by a glowing orange fireball falling from the sky and landing in the middle of the crowded city street just a dozen yards away. A few of the customers screamed and got up, running away, while others just looked on with a curious indifference.
"Oh, man, not on my lunch break,"
Gabrielle muttered, turning to look at the object from space. The glowing meteorite was roughly 12 feet in diameter and cracked open like an egg. This revealed an 8-foot-tall, square-bodied figure with rock-like orange skin and bone protrusions jutting out of his joints and chest. It was twice as large as any muscle-bound bodybuilder, with a craggy face and stringy long white hair coming from the back of its skull. The monster had a big bone protrusion coming out of its chin, almost like a beard. Strangely, it was also wearing a pair of scarlet swim trunks, which were unharmed by the fact he'd just fallen from space. A huge battle axe was attached to its back via a harness, glowing with little black energy dots surrounding it.
"I am Akuma the Accursed," the figure bellowed. "The Harbinger of Pyrenus, the Destroyer, Master of a Dozen Worlds, and Slayer of 1,000 Heroes. I come here to challenge Ultra God to a duel to the death and claim his daughter as my bride."
Gabrielle narrowed her eyes at that last bit, frowning deeply. "Is this common around here?" I asked, looking at the sudden appearance of an alien warlord amongst us.
"You have no idea," Gabrielle muttered, growling. "They're always here to challenge my
Ultra God, never Ultra Goddess, this despite the fact she was trained from birth to be the greatest warrior on Earth."
"It's a man's galaxy, huh?"
Cindy said.
"Ain't that the truth?"
Gabrielle shook her head. Akuma removed his battle axe from his harness and started shaking it.
"My ship sensors detected an Ultraforce energy signature in this area. Someone who has been touched with the power of the First Ones. Show yourself, Ultra God, or I will begin destroying these people."
"Should we get out of here?"
Cindy asked.
"That'd just draw its attention," Gabrielle grumbled. "Moron doesn't even know Ultra God is off in the dimension of Mr. Imagination."
"So we should just wait here?" I said, not sure if we should help evacuate the surrounding citizenry or just wait for the authorities. I wasn't used to being inactive in the face of a threat and hated feeling powerless.
"Take some pictures,"
Gabrielle said, smiling. "The paper would pay big bucks for these. In the meantime, I need to use the bathroom."
"Wait, what?"
I said, watching Gabrielle duck from her table to the interior of the restaurant.
"When you gotta go, you gotta go,"
Cindy said, shrugging.
"Someone should tell her she needs to see a doctor, though, since that's the third time today."
I was about to speak when Akuma pointed at me.
"You, puny mortal!"
"Hm?" I said, having pulled out my cell phone to take a picture.
"You have had sexual contact with an Ultraforce-tainted being!"
Akuma shouted, pointing his axe in my direction.
"Gary, you're cheating on Gabby with Ultra Goddess?"
Cindy said, horrified.
"I'm not,"
I said, stunned. Akuma was serious, though.
"If you have defiled my bride, your pain will be endless!"
I stared at him, fully aware your average alien could obliterate me with a thought.
"I don't know about you, bub, but where I'm from, women can have sex with whoever they want, so fuck off."
Cindy grimaced, then sighed.
"Well, it was a nice life. I only regret it wasn't longer."
Akuma lifted his glowing axe at me, and there was a humming noise, as if it was charging up to do something unpleasant. I didn't bother to move. Instead, I just stared at him, knowing that I would never be someone like him. A predator on the weak. Scum. A murderer of the innocent. Or close to it in my case, at least back then. I was spared from obliteration by the sound of a mighty thwack as Akuma went flying through the air with a force of 100 speeding locomotives. Ultra Goddess had arrived. She moved faster than the Harbinger by a significant amount, catching him in the air before he slammed into a building and then punching him out over the bay. It was a well-known fact that the biggest number of deaths from supervillains wasn't their actual murders, well, at least until the big disaster, but the aftermath of their attacks. That was why every society of superhero member was trained in controlling the direction of a battle. Even so, I couldn't help but notice Akuma was trying to direct the battle back into the center of the city, perhaps in hopes of breaking Ultra Goddess's spirit. "Ever wonder what you'd do with those sort of powers?" Cindy asked, watching the resulting ballet of punches and cosmic energy blasts. "Every day," I said, keeping my eyes squarely on Ultra Goddess. There was something familiar about her that I couldn't place. Little did I know, Gabrielle used her ultra mesmerism in order to make sure my brain, along with the brains of countless other civilians, couldn't put together the fact she was Ultra Goddess. It was a personal betrayal, one I still struggled with, but one I understood, at least. Superheroes had revealed their identities to boyfriends and girlfriends, even spouses, only for them to let them slip or sell them to the media in exchange for immense amounts of cash. Several of these occasions had resulted in tragedy, either the superhero being forced into retirement or their family getting targeted by criminals. People who didn't understand the secret identity thing, who thought of being a superhero as something more or less like being a celebrity, mistook what it was all about. The mob targeted witnesses and investigations in order to prevent them from testifying. What lengths did people think they'd go to avenge themselves on people who threaten their operations every day? What lengths did they think madmen who could build A-bombs in their basement would go to? I'd been on the receiving end of a hero taking advantage of the fact my brother's identity had been open. Cindy kept watching, unable or unwilling to take her eyes off the spectacle.
"Yeah, but then you'd have to live a double life. You'd never be able to open up about who you were."
I shook my head. "Nah, I just live 24/7 as my superhero identity. No point in having a secret identity if you're Stingray or Merciful or Wrathful the entire time."
"Wouldn't that erode Gary Karkovsky? You're kind of cool as is."
"Am I?" I asked sincerely.
"It'd be a shame to lose you."
I had no idea how to respond to that. In the end, Akuma wasn't anything approaching a match for Gabrielle. He had fought Ultra God to a standstill, even defeated him on a couple of occasions. But the Harbinger hadn't come prepared for someone trained by Guinevere of Avalon and the Nightwalker, in addition to her father. His power axe landed on an abandoned car a few blocks away from us, slicing it in half, before Gabrielle unleashed 100 punching Ultraforce energy fists, followed by a gigantic glowing energy hand that slapped him silly. Gabrielle had won the fight by that moment, but she continued for a few minutes more. She conjured an electric chair to shock him, battered him between a pair of gigantic ping-pong paddles, and created a screen full of Tetris blocks she slammed down upon him. Then she brought Akuma down a few yards away from us, smashing him a foot into the pavement, creating a pair of scissors around his neck. The look in Gabrielle's eyes was one of pure hatred and a willingness to kill. At the time, I thought it was Akuma's threat to make her his bride, which was enough to justify his execution in my opinion, but I would later put together that she was just as angry he'd threatened me. Yet as angry as Ultra Goddess was, she held back. Not because Akuma didn't deserve to be killed or because she expected anything good to come from sparing him, but because she was a superhero. Heroes did their very best to inspire people to be better than they are, even if it meant not doing the smart or pragmatic thing. Chaining him up in Ultraforce bonds and sending him flying to the Society of Superheroes base on the moon, she took a moment to look at me.
"Are you all right, citizen?"
Gabrielle asked, disguising her voice and covering her face with a glowing white nimbus.
"Sure," I said, waving to her. "Thank you."
"Stay safe."
Ultra Goddess's voice cracked, letting loose a lot more affection and love than she should have. She then took off into the air.
"Well, that was weird," I said, observing her disappear.
"No kidding," Cindy said.
Seconds later, Gabrielle emerged from the side of the restaurant, covered in sweat and looking like she'd been punched. I got up.
"What happened?"
Gabrielle said.
"Someone hit me in the face while fleeing. Also, the bathroom has, like, no air conditioning."
I blinked, feeling an odd fuzziness in my thinking process.
"Well, that's, unfortunate. I'm glad you're all right, though."
Already the forming bruise on the side of her face was starting to dissipate as the Ultra Force healed over her wounds. Her masquerade wasn't always this effective, and there had been times she'd come home bloody and battered, leaving me to take care of her for the better part of a week. Those times I'd never questioned what she'd been up to had been one of the few reasons our relationship had survived. I'd speculated on her being involved in everything from underground female fight clubs to extreme sports, even that she was a superhero. Just not that she was Ultra Goddess.
That she'd only been willing to tell me after I'd proposed to her. Her response had been to break up with me. After saying yes. Gabrielle was the mother of all mixed signal senders.
Gary is sleeping with Ultra Goddess,
Cindy said, finally putting down her tray.
I am not,
I said. Gabrielle just burst out laughing. Chapter 8. Where the world gets a whole lot darker. Gabrielle continued to stare at me as I remembered that day, and all the others we'd shared together. Gabrielle had been the woman I'd expected to spend my life with before Mandy and our lives just hadn't gone in that direction. The strangest feeling I had looking at her now, I didn't feel the same way I used to. I didn't love her the way I did Mandy. Or Cindy. Crap. I was in love with Cindy.
That's hardly a thing to go crap about. Speak for yourself.
Noticing Ultra Goddess looked like she was ready to punch me in the face, I said,
Wait, could you repeat that? You don't think I'm who I appear to be?
Looking up in the sky, she turned back to me with wild eyes.
I need you to prove you're actually Gary Karkovsky. I mean, I can hear Cloak, and that's a point in your favor, but this has been a very strange day.
Excuse me?
Tell me something only you would know.
Gabrielle said, causing a white-green glow to appear around her right hand as she drew it into a fist. I raised my hands, now alarmed.
I was motivated to become a supervillain by my brother's death.
Not good enough, Gabrielle shouted. It was clear she wasn't thinking clearly. I took a step back.
When we used to do opposites attract for karaoke nights, I made you sing the cat verses.
Gabrielle deflated and caused the glow to fade from her hand.
Okay, well, maybe you are.
For years I thought Madonna's Like a Virgin was about how the sex was awkward and unsatisfying.
Gary.
Sorry, I tend to babble and make bad jokes whenever I'm upset.
Being threatened by your ex-girlfriend, dumped by your henchwoman, and however the hell you describe the Mandy situation, had made this a day perfect for bad jokes.
It's you all right.
Gabrielle pulled me close and wrapped her arms around me, embracing me. She pressed her face against my shoulder, holding me for comfort. It burned a little because she was still hot from the crater she'd fallen into. I hugged her back.
What's wrong?
Gabrielle continued to hold me.
It's awful. My father is dead.
Oh, wow.
No, Cloak whispered. Not Moses. Not Ultra God.
I hated being right. Ultra God had been my first suspect when death had suggested one of the great heroes had died, but it hadn't felt real. Suspecting and knowing were two different things. Hearing it from the daughter of said individual and a close personal friend was something else entirely.
Ultra God had been the champion of the people for 80 years. He'd smashed slumlords, dismantled the KKK, brought down Hitler, humbled Stalin, and came within inches of making the world a paradise on several occasions. In the end, he'd always been prevented from fulfilling his dream by monsters like Tom Terror, Ultramind, the great beasts Entropicus and Pyrrhonus. It was hard to believe he was gone.
The world is doomed without him, Cloak said, devastated. He was the bulwark against the darkness.
Ultra God was an inspiration to hundreds of other heroes, Cloak. Ultra Goddess is every bit as skilled and talented as him, I thought back to him.
Moses was unique.
So is Gabrielle.
Thank you,
Gabrielle said, once again displaying her ability to hear the Reaper's Cloak. It was an ability she'd shared with her father.
I'm sorry, I said, hugging her close.
What happened? Ultra Goddess pulled away.
I don't know.
You don't? I paused, not wanting to interrogate her.
Well, I'm sure we'll find out soon. There'll be state funerals, national days of mourning, hundreds of examinations.
No one knows he's dead.
I blinked. Did he die in space? Another dimension?
No, everyone thinks he's still alive. He's currently heading up the Society of Superheroes annual conference to discuss their role for the year.
Okay, then how?
Moses Anders was found dead in Atlas City. He was shot with a gold ultranium bullet.
Oh, that would do it.
So no one in the society but you knows his secret identity?
My father's was known only to the Nightwalker, you, me, my mother, and Guinevere. Guinevere is currently in Fairyland hunting down Morgana Le Fay and Baelor. We don't expect her back this year.
So, someone is impersonating your father as Ultra God?
Yes.
And when you tried to tell other people?
I was revealed to be a shape-shifting imposter or clone. I'm not sure which.
I didn't really stop to ask when all of my friends and associates tried to kill me. I stared at her. Kill you? That doesn't seem like them. Gabrielle took a deep breath. It's not. I suspect whoever's behind the new Ultra God, they're exerting a subtle influence on the rest of the society. They're meaner and more definitive than they should be.
You mean they're killers?
It sure looks that way. My brother Keith had been a supervillain, albeit one who was never as successful as me at it. Known as Stingray, the underwater assassin, trademark, despite never killing anyone, he had ended up beaten up and in jail more times than I could count. Eventually, he decided to go straight and try to salvage some form of normal life from the crooked path it had taken. That hadn't stopped a wannabe superhero calling himself Shoot-'em-up from killing him at a number of other retired or unarmed supervillains. I had a very low opinion of them for obvious reasons.
"This nightmare grows," Cloak said. "We need to get her inside. The magical wards on the house will muffle her presence, assuming she managed to cover her tracks."
I'd eventually tracked Shoot-'em-up down and shot him the way Cloak described earlier, getting away with it thanks to the fact that Theodore Whitman had made the poor decision of having a minimum of security while he indulged in his passion for underage prostitutes. Shoot-'em-up had been lionized by the media during his short-lived career, though, and triggered an age of murderous anti-heroes that still reverberated through the system. The Society of Superheroes had been torn over the past few years over whether these anti-heroes were to be condemned, embraced, or controlled. Unlike in comic books, most traditional superheroes would kill if there was absolutely no other choice to save lives, but anti-heroes tended to embrace the role of judge, jury, and executioner. They didn't want to be superpowered police or rescue workers so much as soldiers. I also had a very low opinion of them, for obvious reasons.
Yes, because they're going to miss the big glowing comet that hit my backyard.
We'll have to move quickly, Gabrielle muttered.
I agree.
I hated asking my next question, but I had to be absolutely sure.
Are you sure he's dead and not, I don't know, kidnapped or in another dimension or something? This sort of thing has happened before.
If Ultra God was, and I hated using this comparison, really most sincerely dead, then it was the end of an age. He'd been the bedrock of superheroism since the 30s, and the measure by which they all judge themselves. It just wouldn't be the same without him.
Gabrielle nodded.
I sensed his spirit joining the Ultra Force the same way so many other Ultra Heroes of the past have done.
I'll pretend I know what that means.
I can feel him inside my soul like my other dead relatives.
Oh, I know what that's like.
I gave her another hug and started leading her to my kitchen door. You don't have to worry about the Society of Superheroes showing up on your doorstep, at least for a few hours. I managed to fake an Ultra Force explosion over the Himalayas with one of my constructs. It's not going to fool them for long, though, and when they start scanning the Earth, then they're probably going to find me, even with my stealth suit.
I looked at her. That your stealth suit?
Gabrielle looked down at her attire. Yeah, I may need to cover it up with something a little less ostentatious.
Just a little bit, I said, reaching the door and heading on in. Carrie was trying to keep Lisa away in the next room, which was probably a good idea given our present circumstances. What can I do to help?
You're the only person I thought I could turn to.
I understand.
It had been a smart idea coming here. My relationship with Gabrielle was a secret shared with precisely no one outside of our most trusted confidants. The Shadow 7 Black Ops team, Diablo Man, Night Girl, Cindy... Okay, actually, it wasn't a very good secret. Still, if Ultra God's secret identity was secret, then so was Gabrielle's, and that meant our relationship was secret. After all, who in the world would suspect the world's most beloved kid heroine turned adult had dated one of the world's most infamous supervillains?
Most infamous would be stretching things.
Not the time, Cloak.
I offer my decades of service and skills as a detective to this cause. We have to find out who is responsible and put a stop to this.
No argument from me, Gabrielle continued. I need your help, yours and Cindy's, and even your second-in-command Diablo Man. It must have pained Gabrielle to say that, since Diablo Man had been a dire enemy of her teenage years when she was leader of the Texas Guardians. With the superhero world compromised by whatever thing is impersonating my father, you're the best hope I have for tracking down whoever killed my father. We need to find them, punish them, and foil whatever scheme they're planning.
I didn't say that whatever scheme they had planned had already taken a great step forward by killing Ultra God. People had been trying to kill him for the better part of a century, and doing so altered the power balance of the world forever. I believed Gabrielle could pick up the slack and the rest of the superheroes,
but that didn't mean the world wasn't a far darker and more unpleasant place thanks to this event.
Perhaps now is the time to consider becoming a hero for real.
You shut up, I said to Cloak.
I agree with Cloak, Gabrielle said, taking a seat down to the damaged breakfast table.
Now is a time for heroism.
Now is a time for friendship. Everyone on Earth will want to help you avenge Altergod, I'm sure. It wasn't a good time to recruit Cindy, but really I had faith she'd put aside her feelings to help deal with this.
We should also try and talk with Tom Terror, Gabrielle suggested. Get his input on all this.
Okay, everyone on Earth but him. I blinked, not sure I heard that right. You want to recruit the Nazi scientist?
He's done a lot of evil since then. He's not really a Nazi scientist so much as a mad scientist in general.
Jewish supervillain, I said, pointing to myself and explaining why any defense of a former Nazi was talking to a wall.
Point taken.
Tom Terror has also tried to kill you, your father, your mother, your father's best friend, your father's boss, and everyone even tangentially associated with your family. He is, as I know you know, a very bad person, which, given who is speaking, is saying something. Why in the world would you want to speak with him? He's probably the one who killed Altergod.
Tom Terror is one of the few people I can confirm didn't kill Altergod.
Why is that?
Because if he did, he'd be announcing it to the entirety of the world, Gabrielle said, disgusted. He might be able to provide some insight into the possible suspects, though. He's still imprisoned in Atlas City Penitentiary after his transfer from the moon. Whatever you did when you blasted him with a power nullifier has left him kind of batty.
Or so he wants you to think.
This was a bad idea.
That was when Lisa managed to get past Carrie and walked through the king to get into the kitchen. Holding her cell phone, she started to take pictures of Gabrielle.
Holy crap, you really do know Ultra Goddess. This is awesome. I can't wait to post this on...
I grabbed her cell phone from her. You can't share these on Insta whatever or Face Who.
What?
Lisa stared.
Why?
I tried to figure out what would dissuade Lisa from social media and drew up a blank.
Because a bunch of people will come and kill us,
Gabrielle said simply. I'm in hiding, and if people know where I am, then there's nothing that will be able to prevent them from doing so. So please, don't do that.
Lisa blinked, then nodded. Okay, I'll go upstairs and do my homework.
She then walked off robotically. I stared at her, confused, then glared.
Damn it, do not mesmerize my niece.
Sorry, it was just the first thing that came to mind.
Brainwashing should not be the first thing that comes to mind.
Carrie proceeded ahead into the kitchen and started cleaning up the mess on the floor.
I assume breakfast is over?
Yeah, sorry about that, I said, frowning. Carrie, this is Ultra Goddess. Ultra Goddess, Carrie. I tried not to let there be any hints that Gabrielle, my ex-girlfriend whom Carrie knew, was also Ultra Goddess, the world's greatest superheroine. Carrie extended her hand to Gabrielle and shook it.
It's nice to meet you again, Gabby. I'm sorry you and my brother didn't work out.
Ah, so you saw through her disguise, huh? I said, grimacing.
Not really, Carrie said, shrugging. Whenever Gabby and I met while you were dating, she mesmerized me into not make the connection to her secret identity. However, my spooks just told me the truth.
Gabrielle frowned.
Well, keep it to yourself, would you? Secret identities are something some superheroes choose to be without, but not something I intend to be without.
Looking up into the sky out the windows, I said, Yeah, who knows what the consequences of being targeted by a bunch of sinister unknown people could do to your sense of security.
You're talking about the 20 million bounty on your head?
Gabrielle asked. I did a double take.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was issued by President Omega last week. His Department of Superhuman Security contacts has been getting in touch with mercs left and right for it.
Well, crap. Why not just arrest me?
Well, you did kind of bankrupt his corporation, the one he'd intended to return to after his term ended. I think he wants you dead.
Chapter 9. Yet another flashback. I knew the event she was referring to. It had been a few months ago when Cindy had managed to persuade me to try and get back into the game of being a supervillain. The site of our prospective heist? The Falcon Crest City Stock Exchange. The floors were full of frantically working traders. The walls were lit up with monitors depicting the ever-changing price of corn, seed, cloth, microchips, robots, and alien consumer goods. Business had been booming since the fall, It was the biggest tragedy in decades, an event that had caused the rest of America to wake up and take notice of Falcon Crest City's dire situation. Money had poured in to rebuild it from all corners, some of which made it into the hands of its residents. While I was rich enough to not hate the 1% with an instinctive fury, the corruption for Falcon Crest City's rebuilding projects pushed one of my few remaining class warrior berserk buttons, and today was going to be a day when me and my crew took vengeance. I could have just held up the place with a gang of mercenaries like some supervillains, but I wasn't that sort of fellow. No, goddammit, if I was going to get back in the game, then I was going to do it in style. The side of the north wall exploded at exactly 11 o'clock, the prow of a 16th-century pirate ship sailing through the concrete floors of the building and sending rubble forth in every direction. This monumental feat was accomplished through the force field generated around the vessel by my latest henchperson, Nikki Tesla, who was dressed in a mad scientist's overcoat with a pair of thick goggles on her face over a car battery-powered harness she was wearing with a dozen tentacles sticking from her back. I was wearing my usual Sith robe-like attire, but I'd put a Long John Silver's paper pirate hat on my head as well as a fake stuffed parrot on my shoulder. It was held in place with Velcro. In my right hand was a plastic sword covered in very real blood.
"Ahoy there, Warner Street Rapscallions, and prepare to be boarded. 'Tis talk like a pirate day, and we've come here to seize your booty."
"Seize your booty, right?"
my stuffed parrot added. My sister Carrie had a little microphone attached to it so I could get running data on whether the cops were responding or the local millionaire's private armies.
"Yes, the money kind of booty,"
Cindy added, swinging her own sword. She, of course, had adopted the sexy pirate variant of a costume. The countless jacketed brokerage firm's employees, security guards, and a number of people who just appeared to be there for other reasons all started panicking before running in different directions. Those who managed to reach the doors slammed their faces into an invisible force field, the same kind that had allowed my dramatic entrance.
"Great job, Nikki," I said, smiling.
"Jawohl, mein Kapitän,"
Nikki said. I glared at her. "Never say that again, really."
"Ja,"
Nikki said. I cleared my throat and walked over to the edge of the ship.
"Ladies and gentlemen, consider yourself occupied."
I paused. "That's not too dated, is it? Anyway, if you're all willing to cooperate, then this will not take but a moment."
"There's nothing to steal here, though,"
one stockbroker in the back said. I made a tisk-tisk-tisk noise.
"Oh, please, we both know that's not true. Warner Street and its sister avenues are the place where the most theft in the United States goes on. A regular bank may be robbed, an ATM smashed up, or a purse snatched, but it is here where we encounter the big leagues of crime. Just last year, all of you helped prop up the Omega Corporation Rebuilding Initiative, which, along with 50 other corporations, received $40 billion to restore our great city. That's more than twice what was allocated to the rebuilding of Iraq after we invaded it, folks. And do you know how much ended up in the hands of the people?"
There was a guilt-ridden, oppressive silence.
"Two words. First one, Jack. Second one, shit,"
I said, staring them down.
"I'm not a Robin Hood figure. That superhero would consider the recovery of the funds to be the chief priority of my effort. No, my friends, I am a supervillain, and I am quite content with exerting a limited amount of retribution on behalf of the good people of Falcon Crest. People I alone should be allowed to pilfer from. Cindy, would you be so kind to distribute to these good people their boxes?"
"Sure, boss,"
Cindy shouted, taking a selfie of herself with a terrified stockbroker.
"Please note, I am not the reformed supervillain-turned-heroine Red Riding Hood, but Pirate Girl, a wholly distinct and legally unknown supervillainess."
"Yes," I said, rolling my eyes. "That's a really brilliant piece of criminal misdirection there."
"Says the neon sign over his house, guy,"
Cindy snapped back. "You're never gonna let me live that down, are you?"
"No."
"You're gonna force us to sell our stock?"
an elderly man said, looking like he was torn between fear for his life and his fortune.
"Bankrupt us?"
"Oh, no," I said, looking over them. "I am much more devious than that. Diablo Man?" Diablo Man was dressed in his spandex and luchador mask, but had added a 17th-century greatcoat over his head and a patch over his left masked eye. As if accenting the gangland nature of pirates, he also was wearing a great deal of bling, gold necklaces, rings, and other bits of jewelry. Beside him, being held by a leash, was an elderly man who was the key to my current stratagem. The man on a leash was white-haired and Caucasian, with a significant amount of work done and a $20,000 power suit.
On his head was a Christmas tree light-covered colander, which Nikki Tesla insisted was a mind-control helmet. Given the man was drooling out of the right side of his mouth, I couldn't dismiss her statement out of hand. The man was also holding a computer tablet in his hands. "This, folks, is John Wormwood, acting CEO of Omega Industries in lieu of President John Omega, who not only prevented superheroes from intervening in Falcon Crest City during the big disaster, but also managed to secure himself a second term by proceeding to blame Congress as well as the Society of Superheroes for not doing enough. Wow. Since I can't get the president yet, I'm going to settle for the person who personally made over $1 billion from his cut of rebuilding contracts. He's a bad but entirely legal sort of person," Cindy said.
"Many of you have done business with him," Diabloman said, "for which you should all be ashamed."
"The police are not inbound yet," Carrie said via the parrot. "There's a hostage situation with the Chillingsworths nearby." Taking note of that, I put my arm around my hostage.
"Mr. Wormwood here is going to sell a staggering amount of his stock in a few minutes, which, bluntly, will cause a staggering number of other investors to sell their stock due to the large number of rumors the company isn't nearly as solvent as it appears to be, which, given the way they make use of projected earnings and books more fictitious than The Lord of the Rings, maybe